rock at night and steal a little bit of it out of their garden, but there's ways you can find out the characteristics of the neighbor's soil mill. K2KEY, K2LIW in the second half.
Welcome to the W2BL repeater.
KC2OES, we're going to pick you up in a second. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Had a problem with that. If I, for instance, last week, they have to dig a hole about two houses down to repair a sewer line. And you see, oh, God, every layer, different. One layer they found, trash from still in brick laying in it. And it's just a mess. It's all kinds of, it's deep sand, you see white sand, and then it's brown sand, and then it was a lot of bricks thrown in, stones and everything like that. Pieces of remains of old pipes that's still laying in there. So if you want to take a sample of the soil here, if you start digging down, Dick, every couple of feet you come and you find something else. It's all filled in area here, remember? This is all filled in. And when it's filled in, like I say, a truckload arrived with what at this particular area at that time, God knows. You know what I mean? It's not the virgin soil that you can, evaluate. Like I say, you're going to find who knows what in the soil. This is where basically how to describe it. Go ahead, pick up your station.
But there's also cases there, Mel, where the exact answer is not required. I mean, if you made an estimate that your soil has a conductivity of X, and it's really 75% of X, you're going to get an answer that's reasonably good. It's going to tell you the ballpark. So I wouldn't give up. KE2OES, I think it was. Please start up with your name, sir, and then I'll give us your question or comment. Also, you could use a little bit more radio. K2OES, K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is Fred, KE2OES.
Very fine, Fred. Go ahead with your question or comment.
I have a particular situation regarding, I don't know what you would call it, either intermod or some kind, but a local police station transmits, and occasionally it will come through on my 2-meter 440 dual band HD, as well as other situations similar. It's more than one frequency that I get this police station calls on, and I also get airliners overhead somehow bleeding over into some of my frequencies.
Okay. If I was at your house, Fred, and if I started walking increasing diameter circles away from your house, eventually I'm going to come to somebody's fairly strong transmitter, an FM broadcast station, a television broadcast station, a taxi dispatching service, a transmitter tower for the police and fire and emergency and whatever. So if you slowly walked in larger and larger circles around your property, roughly how far away do you think there is a strong transmitter, and what do you think that transmitter is? Back to you for that one first, Fred. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm a little unsure as to what you're really driving at, but in other words, I physically walk around with my HD in normal scan mode and or a particular frequency that I hear other frequencies that shouldn't be on it.
Yeah, good question. I didn't make that clear. In other words, assuming you've lived where you're living for a long enough period of time and that you know what the surrounding terrain is like, not even before you use your handy-talkie, just how many miles or how many blocks in what direction must I walk from your house before I find somebody's strong transmitter that you know about? So back to you, Fred.
Okay, the transmitter that I know of is in two locations. There's a repeater. I believe it's a repeater type station. It's about five blocks from me, and the other one in the other direction of the repeater tower is up on the water tower. That's about maybe 12 blocks.
Okay, 5 blocks and 12 blocks is more than close enough. They only have to radiate a couple of watts, and rare is the rig that's going to be able to tolerate that with some kind of intermodulation distortion, if you use the right word. The good news about our radio receivers, is they can receive extremely weak signals. A state-of-the-art receiver on the band you're listening to right now can give you beautiful sounding output from the loudspeaker if you give it 0.2 microvolt or maybe 0.18 microvolt, an extremely weak signal. We're talking now about minus 120 dB with reference to a milliwatt. And if there's a transmitter down the block that's radiating 5 watts or 50 watts into an antenna a couple of blocks away, it's giving you a signal that's 100 decibels stronger in your receiver than the weakest signal it can receive. Rare is a receiver that has blocking dynamic range of more than 70 or 80 dB. In other words, very few receivers can tolerate a signal that is more than 70 or 80 dB above the weakest threshold the receiver can tolerate. Very few receivers can tolerate that strong a signal, which doesn't take very many watts. If it was right next door to you, a half a watt or a tenth of a watt would do it. And therefore, something in the receiver would be getting a signal that's too strong for it to tolerate. It'll create some degree of nonlinearity, some degree of saturation, flat topping, or whatever. And whenever any one of the stages of your receiver receives any kind of overload, let's call it, you think it's an amplifier, but everything that is nonlinear is simultaneously a mixer. Therefore, all simultaneous signals that come into your antenna port of your receiver under that condition get mixed together in that mixing function of that nonlinear amplifier. They can mix together in all possible combinations. Second harmonic of one subtracts and adds the first fundamental of the other. Third harmonic of one subtracts the second harmonic of the other, and so on. It's called the M by N multiplication. M is a unit number like 1, 2, 3, 4. M for Mary, and N for Nancy is another unit number, 1, 2, 3, 4. An integer. And so the second harmonic of one, the third harmonic of the other, and so on. You take all of those possible integers of the known frequencies, mix them together, and something's going to come out that your receiver wants to respond to. That's what you're listening to. So you got about three solutions. One, move to another area. Don't do that. It's got to throw it in there just in case. Number two, convince them to not go on the air and move away. Don't go there. You're wasting your time. Number three, Fred, you have the technology to put in the right kind of a filter. If you had a filter, and you can build or buy one, which passes nothing but 144 to 148 megacycles, the ham band that you care about, if you had a band pass filter that has 40 dB of rejection everywhere else outside of that frequency range, but only 1 dB of insertion loss inside of that frequency range, you would never hear any of those other signals again. You'd only hear ham radio signals. And you might still hear some distortion if during a contest, a guy does a contest operation 3 blocks from you, and he's radiating a kilowatt. You're going to hear some funny things because now they're coming through your filter. But with a bandpass filter, that's the Cadillac solution. And it's going to take you some effort to find, design, buy, whatever. Get your hands on the right kind of a filter. That's the Cadillac solution. The Volkswagen solution is to say that, gee, most of the time it's the one guy that's closest to me. He's only 3 blocks away. He's on this particular frequency. You can follow the rules that Mel was telling you about a couple of weeks ago, where you can find the right article in the technical topics of QST Magazine, where you design for yourself a coaxial stub tuner, coaxial stub reject tuner. It consists of nothing more than a T connector in your transmission line, with the right length of coax going off to the side of that T connector into a short circuit. You make that T connector transmission line, the stub off to one side, the right length, and it rejects that particular frequency, nulls it out, and your rig never gets overloaded again. So if there's one main signal that's strong, you can reject that one signal. That's the simple, cheap solution. But I call it the Volkswagen solution. It's inexpensive, but it doesn't take you everywhere. It'll take out the majority of your problem, the guy that's 3 blocks away, but it may not also remove the guy that is 10 blocks away. Well, you can put a second stub tuner in and tune it to the frequency of the guy 10 blocks away. So, as you can see, now that you know what it is, You know that it's overloaded the receiver from strong local signals coming down your antenna cable. There's ways you can stop those signals from getting into your rig and stop that action from happening. There are other solutions, but those are the direct approach, and maybe that's enough for you to discuss right now, Fred. KE2OES, K2LAW on the tech net. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. One correction. Excuse me. It's Kilo Charlie 2, Oscar Echo Sierra. And two quick points. It doesn't happen all the time. It's just indiscriminately, and it comes in, I don't know any other way to explain it. It just booms in all of a sudden. I know where this transmission is coming from. And can you explain why it doesn't happen all the time? And another crazy situation is I have, when I'm using my 10-meter radio, I have an AM station that comes in on 27 megahertz on my 10-meter radio, and it's unbelievable the signal that he's putting down my antenna.
Okay, when it comes to the intermittency of this, there's two solutions, there's two explanations for that one, Fred. Number one, if you had a scanner that could cover your local police department and you listened to it, you would find out that by definition, by training, their transmissions are very brief and infrequent. In other words, five times per hour, somebody talks to a squad car and says, please do such and such, or tell me so and so. And it's a 10-second transmission a few times per hour. That's one possible explanation. In other words, the transmissions themselves are intermittent. It's not a continuous broadcast like literally over-the-air broadcast is. Second of all, there are the possibilities where you need two simultaneous strong signals to get the problem. In other words, the guy that's three blocks away intermittently transmitting and the guy that's 10 blocks away intermittently transmission must both be on the air simultaneously. One may be a taxi cab dispatching service and the other one may be the police department. And only when they're both on the air simultaneously is your rig really overloaded and giving you this condition. So as you can see, you have probability of intercept of the actual condition being intermittent for those particular reasons. That's part of what I think can be causing it. And again, it's very solvable. Every interference problem, once you understand it, is solvable. I didn't say it's easy. There's a bit of a learning curve required to find out what is the susceptible piece of equipment, which is your rig, what is the method of response. If you could borrow somebody's scanning receiver or spectrum analyzer, you'd find out real fast who the strong guys are. That's a direct approach. But you just walking around the block and finding out what frequencies they're on and building reject filters for that is the next approach. A bandpass filter is the Cadillac approach I talked about before. Also, the local amplitude modulated station. A good AM radio station would love to run either 5 or 50,000 watts. And even though it's a mile away from you, again, that's another extremely strong signal, which, depending on the design of your antenna, could be coming down the feed line and giving you grief. Every one of these can be filtered. The magic of a filter is it passes some frequencies with almost no attenuation. And all other frequencies, it can reject them with numbers like 40 decibels real easily. 40 decibels is a 10,000 to 1 ratio. In other words, if the strong signal that you don't want to listen to is outside of the bandpass of your filter, and if the filter has got 40 dB of rejection at that frequency, let's say it's the police dispatching frequency, that means that the amount of signal that still gets through your filter and gets into your radio will be 1/10,000th the strength it was before. Guarantee your radio is going to be a lot happier when you use that filter. So, identifying the frequencies, finding out what frequencies you need to reject, or just go out and buying a filter that passes your favorite frequency. And it can either be a filter that tunes 144 to 148. That's going to be a little bit pricey. Or you can homebrew a filter that you can use as a manual tracking filter. You build for yourself one cavity that passes 144 to 148 megs. When you turn the knob on the cavity filter, which turns a simple variable capacitor at the far end of the tuning rod inside of that filter, just a one-pole filter, which you When you're at the high end of the band, you tune the dial on the filter to the high end, and so on. You put markings on the outside of the knob of the on the outside of the filter. And so you could use a tracking filter, much simpler to build, out of home glue materials. A piece of copper pipe will do that for the outer pipe and brass pipe down the center, and a little coupling coil going in and out. And so the fact that it now tunes to the exact frequency you're listening to would have even more rejection and have less expense than the filter that passes the whole 4 megacycles. To pass 4 megacycles with low insertion loss and have high insertion loss everywhere else, it's going to take you a multi-pole filter. In other words, if it's a 5-pole filter, there's going to be 5 resonators in there with just the right coupling coefficients between them in order to do that. That's a bit of a serious engineering problem. You can get the exact same performance with a single-pole filter as long as you're willing to tune it to the frequency you're listening to now. And there's been some nice articles on how with $10 worth of materials you can build that filter and this problem can go away. And it'll be a great learning curve in the process, Fred. Kilo Charlie 2, Echo, Oscar Echo Sierra, K2RW. You got it, Fred.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, I understand exactly what you're talking about, but I wasn't sure that that's what I was dealing with. And you basically answered my question. I'm just going to keep trying to figure out how to build the filter, buy a filter, so on and so on. Two things, though. The AM station that I spoke about, he didn't name. I don't know what his power is, but I know he talks, he mentions his hometown and the state just about every time it happens. And I'm located in across the bay from you guys here. I'm in, over in Kingsburg. And he just powers like somebody turned the volume knob up. He just blows my speaker away. It's unbelievable. And that's about it. I'm going to be on the side. I have to run to the oven, but I will be listening. I have some ties I have to pull out.
Very fine, Fred. A broadcast station that's in Maine, when the band is in good shape, can come into your backyard as a really potent signal. Now, the main signal itself is not, in my opinion, overloading your radio. However, when your radio is overloaded by a local signal, all of a sudden, it has a way of listening, and even though you don't want it to, of listening to that main signal. So, that's not unusual. It's a little unusual, but it's not crazy. So, Keensburg, New Jersey. Lincoln Court. Oh, yeah. Like, Lincoln Court. Lincoln Court. Can't pronounce that one. Where you live, Fred. But I think you're close to where there's a number of broadcast stations. I know that in that neighborhood at one time, ABC, CBS, NBC, I think you used to have some of the AM broadcast stations not too many miles away from you. So lots of good filtering is going to be required. And it's not going to cost you a whole lot to do it. Good luck with that project, Fred. By the way, whether you're successful or not successful, please come back and let us know about it, because your problem is not unique. Guarantee there are other people listening to us who have run into it. Okay, is there anyone else who wants to add or subtract from anything they've heard of the above? Give us your call that is right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WB2CQT.
WB2, Charlie Quebec Tango. Start off with your name, sir, and then come proceed with your question or comment.
Name is Larry. I have a comment on his last thing there and a question for you after that. If he found a helical front end from an old two-way radio that can be tuned to these ham frequencies, that would be fine. But you can't transmit through it, as far as I understand. So you'd have to switch around it for transmitting. That's just one thought I had there. And my question is there an advantage to having your antenna tuner right at the antenna? Let's say you have your house and your line out to the antenna is maybe 50 feet long or more. You could either have the antenna tuner on your desk or right at the base of the antenna or at the antenna. What do you think? Is there an advantage?
Okay. When it comes to the helical filter, The good news about a helical filter is it's nice and compact. And you're absolutely right, though. As I see it, Larry, most helical filters, because they're compact, high in Q, cannot tolerate a great deal of power, so you might not be able to transmit through it without arcing it over. The advantage of building a homebrew large diameter or large volume filter is that it can tolerate a kilowatt of power, quite possibly, if you use the right kind of materials. And he doesn't need to solve his problem. He might not be forced into making it super compact. Yes, if it was a mobile rig, putting a great big filter in the car is not easy. But the nice thing about a car is you don't dwell in one spot when you're getting a lot of interference. You're continuously moving. So every time you drive past the broadcast station for a couple of blocks, you've got the problem, and as you go further down the highway, it goes away and you don't care about it. Whereas in your shack, you'd like the problem to be solved over time. So therefore, you're willing to tolerate a larger volume filter. And as the volume of the filter goes up, the power it can tolerate almost always gets larger and larger. And to build a filter that'll solve this problem that can tolerate a kilowatt is not out of the question. It just requires a little bit of careful engineering. Now, when it comes to an antenna tuner, once we realize what an antenna tuner can do for us, we can almost answer the question whether or not it's better to be at the antenna or in the shack. The answer is not clear. Without a doubt, the antenna tuner at the antenna is slightly better in every single case. However, the level of improvement, in many cases, is so small, it's absolutely not worth all of the heroic effort to get the antenna tuner at the antenna. If you can correct the impedance right at the source, right at the horse's mouth, right at the antenna itself, and force your antenna to be exactly 50 ohms resistive if you're using 50 ohm cable, or 300 ohms resistive if you're using 300 ohm twin leads, that's going to give you the most efficient system. But locating an antenna tuner out there on the antenna up in the air is usually a pain. What the antenna tuner does is it takes all reflected energy from the antenna, re-reflects it forward with just the right phase so that it adds the power your transmitter is now generating. And if you do that in the shack, the only reason why that's a slight disadvantage is now the signal reflected from your antenna comes back down your transmission line a second time, comes back to the shack toward the transmitter, hits the antenna tuner, and the antenna tuner, when it's properly set, all of that power gets re-reflected back up the feed line and eventually gets radiated. The catch is that now the power that's being reflected is going through your transmission line multiple times, therefore it's experiencing the loss of the transmission line multiple times. If your transmission line had 1 dB of loss, then all of your reflected power has an additional dB of loss when it comes back to you, and another dB of loss when it goes forward again and hits the antenna a second time. A total of 3 dB of loss with 1 dB of cable. So not all of the power gets re-radiated. Some of it gets lost as heat in the cable because the signal is bouncing back and forth through a cable with insertion loss. If you can keep the insertion loss of your cable low enough, then the fact that the signal is bouncing forth, back and forth, does not matter. If you're using open line, open wire transmission line, for instance, where your feed line loss is a tenth of a dB, and the signal has to bounce 3 times, and it gets 3/10 of a dB of loss, that's so low you can't measure it without very good laboratory equipment, in which case, 99% of the time, you want to keep the antenna tuner in the shack. Now, there are compromises to this. The whole antenna tuner, the thing you buy from MFJ or anybody other good brand, not all of it has to be in the shack. If you know that your particular antenna is close to 50 ohms on its resistive component, but it just happens to have a whole lot of inductive reactants at the same time, and if you put a shunt capacitor at the antenna to cancel the inductive reactants for the center of the band that you care about, then you've done 95% of the antenna tuning at the antenna, and all you've done is to hang a capacitor up there. And that capacitor could be nothing more than a length of coax cable on a T connector that's hanging on the side of the antenna, if you know what I mean. A stub tuner. A stub tuner can give you any capacitance or inductance that you want by just choosing the right length of the tuner. So you can now have your cake and eat it too. You can do 90% of the matching at the antenna and the last 10% in the shack, and now even a lossy feed line is still going to give you majority of the performance you want. So once you understand the details of it, I think you see the kinds of trade-off you can do here, Fred. Your problem, Larry, is you've got two or three solutions for your particular QTH, and now you've got the problem of choosing the best one for you. You've got more than enough solutions. WB2, CQT, KQRIW in the TechNet.
This is W2EWK. I can solve your problem right now.
Now, we're going to come back to you in a minute, Eugene. Larry first. Go ahead, Larry.
Okay, thank you very much. I absorbed everything, but I don't have that kind of setup where I could have an antenna outside. Anyway, I just was pondering the question. So I'll just be listening here, and thank you again.
Okay, when you finally decide where you're going to put the tuner and how well it's going to work, let us know about that, Larry. Come back and tell us what you find. Eugene, what's the magic solution to all this, Eugene? And why have we been waiting so long to get this answer? You've got it, Eugene.
Well, Dick, the reason why you have waited so long is because I had to go to my book. Now, I'm in the page of my book, and I can help the man very easily. Now, it might cost him a little bit of money, but the problem's going to be solved. He can transmit through the filter, okay? It's called a bandpass filter. It's called Digital Communications Company. It's DCI. Okay, there's a filter for 2 meters. There's a filter for 220. There's a filter for 440. There's a filter for 2 meters and 440. So he has those choices. It's on page 28, on page 28, and the company that sells the filter is called Ham Radio Outlet. In the winter catalog, 2007. If he calls him up, I'd be very happy to send the filter out to him. QSL?
Very fine, Eugene. And yeah, you're not solving Larry's problem, you're solving Fred's problem. Fred has the strong local broadcast stations and police and whatever that's overloading his receiver. So you found a beautiful solution to Fred's problem, and DCI apparently has the hardware. Do you have any idea, Eugene, how many dollars is that DCI filter? Is it $30 or $300 if you happen to know? You've got it, Eugene.
Okay, I think you better take some rubber bands and some locks and lock up his wallet. I'll tell you this right now. Because the filter is not cheap. But I'm pretty sure the man has enough shekels inside the bank or a credit card or something to take care of it. Okay, for the 2 meter only, $169.95. For the 220, $169.95. And for the 440, $189.95. For the 2 meters and 440, it's $239.95. Now, would you like to have that with salad or beans or coffee or soda? W2EWK.
I want that with apple pie a la mode. Okay, Eugene. Yeah, it's a little bit pricey. I was afraid of that. Well-designed filters are a little bit pricey. There's a fair amount of technology in there, a fair amount of hardware, some exotic tuning. You've got to have a number of simultaneous resonators, 3, 5, 7 resonators. They call them poles. And just the right coupling coefficient between those resonators, just the right input impedance match and output impedance match, all of it in a strong enough box that it can hold its integrity even though you tap it on the bench by mistake and so on. And it's got to have enough stealth and cunning that it can tolerate a transmitter. So I can see why a thing like that is $169, $149, numbers like that. But a crafty ham radio operator can literally take tomato juice cans or tomato cans, tomato paste cans, tomato sauce cans, solder them together end to end and make himself a piece of tubing and put another piece of copper pipe down the center and build himself a cavity filter. Or he can take large and small diameter brass and copper tubing there's various ways you can make a coaxial cavity filter, single pole, single resonator, and literally walk it across the band when you tune to the high or the low end of the band. And so he can have his cake and eat it too. By that I mean he doesn't have to spend a lot of money if he wants to take that approach. And he can have a filter that passes nothing essentially but the frequency he's listening to. Part of what goes on is that the very first radio, DC-345, I think it was, made by Yaesu, that was popular on 2 meter, as a 2 meter all mode, did have a electronic tracking filter to the front end. You can tell when you see one of those rigs, because it tunes across the 2 meter band, 144 to 148, by having a great big range switch with about 8 steps to it, where it tunes half a megacycle at a time. And you're doing the coarse tuning for the tracking filter when you adjust that range switch. And people didn't like that for whatever reason. And the good news about the modern rigs is that you don't have a range switch on it. You just tune the main frequency dial, and it tunes 144 to 148. That's the good news. It's simpler to use. The bad news is the front end is pretty wide open, not very much filtering to it, and it can let through very strong signals on out-of-band frequencies that can give you some grief. That Yaesu DC-345, I think it was the model number of the darn thing, it really was an extremely bulletproof receiver. You could be listening to 146.85 with that Yaesu receiver, transceiver, and an extremely strong moonbound guy on 144 megacycles comes along. He's one block away from you, and he's radiating 1,500 watts, and you wouldn't even know he's there with that particular tracking filter receiver. You do that with most of the rigs we all own, and the thing's going to jump off the table, and it's going to give you all kinds of crazy responses when it gets a signal that strong, even though you're not tuned to it. So every radio has a signal strength at which it becomes overloaded. And in some cases, it's called the blocking dynamic range. Sometimes it's called the spur-free dynamic range. It's got a lot of fancy names to it. It's called the third-order intercept point. There's a lot of different words and a lot of different ways of measuring it. But essentially, every single receiver, which is made for receiving extremely weak signals, that's the nature of radio, microvolt-type signals, and fractions of a microvolt signal. And you put a signal in there that's a volt instead of a microvolt, you're putting a signal that's in there 120 decibels stronger than the receiver was designed for. So it's going to do some funny things. It's equivalent to a guy that's 9 feet tall trying to get into an ordinary elevator. He's going to bump his head on something. Well, you put very strong signals into your receiver, and you could say the strong signal is going to bump into something, create some nonlinearity, and you're going to be hearing signals you're not tuned to. And with a little bit of mathematical study, you'll figure out where it's coming from. With a little bit of smarts, you'll figure out how to eliminate it. Anybody got any further comments on this? K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes,
that,
what's that? DC what?
Tango, Tango, Tango. Go ahead, Gordon first, and then we'll come back to Eugene. You got it, Gordon.
You know, there was a KDK 144. I forget what the actual, model number was, but it's called a KDK FM receiver, a transceiver. And then they had the 2015 and the 2016. And all of those had Varactor-tuned front ends, which serve to provide that kind of tracking filter. And when they worked well, and when they did work, they were a mess. But everybody I know who had one, they worked well. In fact, I had one. I had a 144, then I had 2016, and they worked extraordinarily well doing exactly that tracking filter function you're talking about. And a lot of radios today, Dick, will do that. They do provide some level of tracking filter. So it's just something to think about. I mean, it's not quite as bad as, you know, we'd like to suggest sometimes. God knows there's some without tracking filters, but there are some out there with tracking filters that are pretty good.
Very fine, Gordon. The ones with tracking filter, to my knowledge, are a little bit rare. You're listening to right now an old clunker, a Kenwood TS711A is what I'm using. But on the front panel, it's got this third button over from the left called the attenuator button. You press that button, it plugs a 20 decibel attenuator into the front end. This rig, by the way, is broadbanded from 140 to 150. I can tune anywhere in there and nothing will go there. So it tunes the whole 10 megacycles, but it's got a wide open front end to do that. It has essentially no tracking filters that I know about. But when you get a strong local signal, that's another solution. As long as the signal you're listening to is not super weak, you can quite often tolerate 10 or 20 decibels of insertion loss of an attenuator, a pad as they call it, between your antenna port and the receiver. Or if your receiver has got an attenuator on the front panel, you press the button and the attenuator is dialed in automatically. Or if your rig has a preamplifier dialed in and it's got a push button that will bypass the preamplifier. In either case, if I press my attenuator switch on my 10-wig 711, 20 decibels of attenuation is plugged into the antenna port in the receive mode only. Therefore, all signals get 20 dB weaker, and even that super strong signal 3 blocks away, when it's 20 dB weaker, which is 100-to-1 power ratio, 98% of the time, I've got no grief anymore. And during contest operations on 432 megacycles, I'm sitting up here on a 300-foot hill on Long Island, and I overlook the Long Island Sound with great line of sight on the top of my 100-foot tower. And when you get some of these big contest operations in Connecticut, near the shore, radiating kilowatts on lots of bands, the overload my receiver would get would be fierce. And I would have a step attenuator in front of the receiver. I would dial in the right number of dB so that I wouldn't get overload from the contest operation a small number of miles from me with direct line of sight. And the weak signal I'm listening to suddenly was very pleasant to listen to, 98% of the time. So attenuation and dialing out your preamplifier also makes a huge improvement when it comes to strong signal overload. A lot of people don't know that. It seems to be a well-kept secret. I mean, to listen to a weak signal when you're being bombed, it sounds like craziness to plug in an attenuator to make the weaker signal weaker. But because of the way intermodulation distortion works, you get a 3-to-1 or a 5-to-1 improvement ratio. If it's a third-order intermodulation distortion product that is from a strong local signal that is burying the signal you want to listen to, and you plug in 10 dB of attenuation, the weak signal you want to listen to goes down exactly 10 dB. The third-order intermod signal that was burying him goes down by 30 dB. You come out 20 dB ahead. Almost all third-order intermodulation distortion signals obey that 3-to-1 rule, and if it's fifth-order intermodulation distortion, it obeys a 5-to-1 rule. So attenuation can be a great way of recovering overload of a receiver. Anyone with any further comments, give me your call. This is K2LIW.
I have one more.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that. There's, on my 756 Pro 3, which in oh so many ways is just an outstanding receiver, it has one characteristic that mirrors what you just said, and that is that it's got in addition to preamps of various flavors, it has an attenuation in three levels, or four levels, 0, 6, 12, and 18 dB. And with the spectrum scope on it, on the display, it's fascinating when you do find an IMD product, it follows that rule that you talk about very clearly.
Yeah, when you're looking at a good spectrum display or a spectrum analyzer display, and you see this third-order intermodulation signal characteristic, the first time you see it, it's kind of amazing. If you're doing a two-tone test of either the linearity of a transmitter or the response of a receiver, but you're plugging in two equal amplitude tones, and because of something nonlinear in the receiver, if the two tones are, let's say, 10 kilohertz apart, another pair of tones will appear. One 10 kilohertz above the highest of the two tones, another one 10 kilohertz lower than the lowest two tones. So you're slowly constructing this Christmas tree of vertical lines on the oscilloscope. And then you plug in the 10 dB attenuator, you'll watch the two main tones that are coming out of the signal generator you'll watch them go down by 10 dB, and you'll watch the tones on the side go down by 30 dB. And if there's tones outside of those, fifth order tones, you'll watch them go down by 50 dB. The bottom line of all that is that when you're using a spectrum analyzer or a spectrum display of any kind, and you're looking at a rich array of signals on that screen, and you want to know to yourself, when you ask yourself the question, are all those signals real, or are some of them an intermod product of the fact that my receiver is being overloaded? And you can ask yourself the exact same question when you're looking at a spectrum analyzer display. How do I know I'm not overloading the front end of the spectrum analyzer? And the answer is you plug in a 10 dB pad, for instance, on the front end of the spectrum analyzer, and if the spectrum analyzer is behaving in a linear manner, or if the spectral display, your pan adapter on your receiver, is displaying in a linear manner, is if the whole receiver is working in a linear manner, then every single tone, every single signal on that screen should go down by exactly 10 decibels when you plug in a 10 dB attenuator. When you plug in the 10 dB attenuator in front of whatever that instrumentation is, spectrum analyzer or receiver, if any of those tones move by any other ratio, then you can rest assured that some kind of nonlinearity is taking place, and you better go very slow before you start accusing somebody of making splatter and him having a bad transmitter. You may have a less than ideal receiver. You'd be amazed how many times a guy hears some splatter when there's a long, strong local signal, and he says all kinds of derogatory remarks to the guy who runs that transmitter, and the real fault could be in your own receiver. Until you've done that confirmation test I just described, I recommend you not start screaming at that guy who's running that transmitter. He could be okay, and you could be wrong. There's a one slight catch to what I just said, and that is modern-day spectrum analyzers have a microprocessor built in that tries to automate everything, and the thing tries to be an idiot-proof machine. And therefore, if you set it in such a way that the top of the screen is defined as a reference level of minus 20 dBm, for instance, and if you use the internal RF front-end attenuator that's inside the spectrum analyzer, you turn that knob, so to speak, because you've added 10 dB of extra attenuation, and because you've also, in a previous command, told the machine to keep the top of the screen referenced at minus 20, you plug in 10 dB of RF attenuation at the front end, and it adds 10 dB of extra gain in the IF strip to compensate, so that the reference level stays the same. You've asked for one change, and he's given you two changes. And if it was an IF amplifier that was being overloaded, all of a sudden he's negated what you're trying to do, that microprocessor. You've added 10 dB to the front end, he's added 10 dB more gain to the back end, and that core stage that's being overloaded is still being overloaded. I've run into that problem so many times where I start using strong, salty language with the guy that designed the spectrum analyzer. In the old days, when they weren't so automated, I could independently dial that front end RF attenuator. I'm now forced to pick up a manual 10 dB attenuator and unscrew the connector on the front end and put it on there myself. That's the only way I can fox the damn microprocessor that's inside. I wonder if you've ever run into that problem, Gordon. W2TTT, KQLIW.
You could just, what's going to be automated and what's not, but, you know, you're right, they make it stupid for a thing. And it is going to be a double difficult TV task, but it's a thought and tip that someone put in. Having that and having the hiking filter, and by the way, the 46 Pro has something similar, but I don't think it's quite as elaborate. It's got a couple of preamps, and it's got, I think, at least one level of attenuation. I don't use it as often on the 46 Pro. But another experiment I'm going to be doing shortly is getting the 736 and the 756 Pro going with Downey's Vapor Transverters. It's been a while. I got that project started, and that'll be another thing in the future. I'm looking forward to that. That my hand is forced. I have to make one of the other two work. And I've done the broadband transmit on the 46 Pro. I haven't done it on the 56 Pro. And that's kind of handy too, because my I-22 is not 28 megahertz, but 30. I just realigned everything and didn't recrystal when we lost the bottom of the band. Anyway, K2RW, back to normal people, W2 TTJ.
Very fine, Gordon. I'm listening to Gordon on the input, and he was a little bit weak on some of those transmissions on earlier. He's behind a hill there in New Jersey, I think. And also, this particular repeater has an intentional null in its antenna pattern in the direction of Frenchtown, New Jersey, because Frenchtown also has a repeater on this exact same frequency. So there are certain places in New Jersey where if you're in that null in the pattern, it's more difficult to get through to this repeater, even though you're at the right range where your signal should come through as gangbusters. And what Gordon was mentioning is the fact that not only is there an automatic microprocessor in a spectrum analyzer that will fox you and fight you when you try to do this test, but he was mentioning the fact that some of the automatic cameras these days, where you're trying to readjust the f-stop or the timing of the lens in order to get a special effect, and the microprocessor inside will fight you, and it keeps moving the other variable on you, even though you don't want it to. And you have to go to special menus to lock the darn thing down to stop it from doing its thing. It's great to have a point-and-shoot camera that's idiot-proof, but if you're trying to do a special effect where you intentionally want overexposure or underexposure, the darn thing won't let you do it until you can kill its function, so to speak, until you can say, hey, go to sleep, microprocessor, and let me do my thing. I'm the photographer. I've got the brains of this outfit. I wonder if you've ever run into any problems like that, Mel. And Mel, maybe it's time you start scanning and see what you've got in your mailbag this week.
Zach?
Oh, go ahead, Eugene. I know Eugene wanted to say a few words. You got it, Eugene.
Yes, what was the number of the Yaesu that you were talking about? The DC, what's the number of it? It's the DC question mark.
I think it was Baker Charlie, DC 345, this was a rig, a 2-meter all-mode transceiver, manufactured approximately 1985, way back in the dark ages. One of the very first synthesized 2-meter all-mode rigs, and I know it was Yaesu. I've forgotten the model number of the darn thing, but it did have a beautiful tracking filter, and that's the good news. In the sideband mode, it had a kind of a mushy sounding audio, so I wasn't completely happy with that rig. FM-wise, it was kind of good. In the sideband mode, the audio was kind of mushy. I like sideband audio to have 3 or 4 KC of bandwidth to it. Everybody these days likes to build 1.8 and 2.0 KC filters, and all the high-frequency notes get chopped off, and though for intelligibility under weak signal conditions are very marginal. I used to talk to a guy way down in Greensboro, North Carolina, K4 Charlie Alpha Whiskey is his call letters. He's now a silent key. But his name was Al, and I would be 480 miles apart. And we were sending single sideband signals to each other on 432 megacycles very successfully. We did it for 4 solid years. Well, some of his buddies nearby wanted to join in on this operation, and they were using rigs that had very narrowband sideband filters. And so with weak signal conditions, I wasn't able to get their audio, even though this signal was 5 dB stronger. I couldn't hear what they're saying. I hadn't learned their vocabulary. That was part of it, was Al's vocabulary. I knew what he was going to say to me to some degree. And so I knew his vocabulary, and I could tolerate very weak signal in the sideband mode. But that was a fun operation. We found out what very long-range communication is like. My radio horizon from the top of my tower is roughly 40 miles away. And here I am talking to somebody 480 miles away. That is what? 12 times further away than my radio horizon. and we're doing that on single sideband on 432, summer, winter, spring, and fall, in the snow, in the rain, and so on, and studying the conditions. It was a fun project. I never got a chance to write an article on that one. So sideband bandwidth is very important. Tracking filters and rigs are very important. Microprocessors inside can sometimes bite you when you want to do some good testing. These are some of the subjects we've just been talking about. And if you want to add or subtract anything further from this, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, you looked at the relief at the antenna and the kilowatt amplifier.
What was that again, Gordon? Please repeat.
Yeah, you left out the really big amplifier and the really big antenna array.
Oh, yeah. Part of what made that successful. Yeah, very good. I was using 16 Yagis of 19 elements each, 304 elements. The antenna doing the transmitting on my side was 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep. It's 5,000 cubic feet of antenna mounted on 100 on the top of 100 feet of tower on 300 foot above sea level land, which by Long Island standards is high. Now that's a molehill, but compared to New Jersey, and it was probably an 80% over water pass between me and Greensboro, North Carolina, although he was 200 miles inland, so maybe it was 60% over water pass. He was using four very good Yagis on a 100 feet of tower. We were both running a kilowatt of sideband power on 432. And so when you got enough steam for transmit and enough effective capture area in the receiver and low enough noise figure, well, I found out later on that I did that operation for 4 years with a system that had about an 8 decibel noise figure. I had extra loss in the cables I didn't know about. I had a front end that was nothing to write home about, and this was 1985 vintage hardware. Had I been using a modern-day fraction of a dB noise figure receiver, my goodness, would that have been a lot more pleasant in both directions. We both had about the same copy in both directions. So he had a little bit less antenna. I had a heck of a lot less noise figure, and the system sort of balanced, if you know what I mean. But I now know that that could have been a lot better. I'd love to repeat that experiment again. With modern-day gas-fed amplifiers, I can get 4/10 or 3/10 of a dB of noise figure instead of 8 dB noise figure. That's going to make a huge improvement. I can put up a little bit more antenna gain. I can even radiate a little bit more power. My transmitter then only ran a 700 watts output peak envelope power. I could be running 3 dB more power and 7.5 dB less noise figure. I could bore a hole in that ionosphere, if you know what I mean, Gordon. W2GTG, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, Dick, when you were doing that and the things you did leading up to that, I was in high school, college, and newly married and wasn't quite up to having, you know, a full-blown ham shack quite yet again, even though we were probably about a year into the house at that point. We've been there now 24 years. So, you know, I would read this about your adventures or hear about your adventures, and I would just drool. So it was like, oh, man. The largest I ever got was 8 5-element quads on 2 meters. I think that's the largest array I ever put up. And I've heard my own echoes off the moon, and that was kind of cool. But couldn't elevate it. It was a mess to rotate and such. It was... The horizontal boom, I kid you not, was made of wood. But anyway, I'll leave it at that. Anyway, I'll shut up. I've been talking too much tonight. W2TTT.
Now, don't worry, Gordon. Join us more often. One of my first serious antennas also had a wooden boom because it was a cross-polarized Yagi. 6 elements on 6 meters, 6 elements horizontal, 6 elements vertical. And the mast was made out of a good chunk of wood that came out of a small sailboat. And it was varnished so that the mast didn't do too much interference with the vertical polarization. That was a fun antenna on 6 meters. I could flip back and forth in polarization. So among the guys who are really serious experimenters, in the old days, we would build our own transmitter, we would build our own receiver. Nowadays, a modern-day transmitter with frequency lock loop and digital signal processing and tunable IF and whatever. It's got so darn many things inside the receiver. Nobody, not one ham in a thousand, is going to build his own receiver. Not one ham in a thousand is going to build his own transmitter anymore. It ain't worth it. To build your own transmitter by modern standards, it's going to take you 5 years of your life. You can buy something that's a little bit better with 1 week of your salary, if you know what I mean. So you're way ahead of the game. When such high technology exists from Southeast Asia, you just go and buy it. But when it comes to the antenna, that's a different ballgame. If you're a serious experiment, and no matter what you put up for an antenna, if you make it a little higher and a little bit bigger, I guarantee it's going to reach further. It's going to hear things that no one's ever heard before. People are going to hear you in distances you've never been heard before. And it's a lot of fun to start bragging about it. You don't have to brag. Just say, I'm running a so-and-so. And people will say, wow, I wish I had one of those. And you sit back there and gloat. And you don't even have to tell them that you're gloating, if you know what I mean. It's fun. Let's face it. We all like to be king of the mountain once in a while. And so that's where the place where we can do an awful lot. You take, for instance, Joe Wright, the W1JR. Once in his article in the CQ magazine, his VHF article, said that once your antenna is high enough on VHF, UHF frequencies to clear the trees, going any higher doesn't buy you anything. You just get more feed line loss. He was expressing an opinion. He was expressing a sincerely felt opinion, and with the experiments you did with his 100-foot of tower, he thought that was true. Well, you get a hold of a guy named Dave Olean, K1WHS, where his antenna is 150 feet of tower on top of a 1,500-foot mountain, and the mountain is on his property. And so he does experiments where he can have an antenna that's 100 feet above the trees, another antenna that's 150 feet above the trees, and he can flip back and forth between the two. Higher altitude always gives you more signal. I ran a similar experiment. With that array of 16 Yagis, I could tune to one single Yagi by flipping the relay. I could tune to one single Yagi at the top of the array at about the 105-foot level, or I could go to the separate Yagi of an identical type at the 75-foot level that was hanging on a yard arm off the side of the tower with a separate rotator. So I could flip back and forth with one Yagi at the 75-foot level and one Yagi at the 105-foot level. And my trees were roughly 75 feet up. So the bottom Yagi was just clearing the trees. The upper Yagi got 10 decibels more signal almost every day of the year, no matter who I listened to, no matter what direction. I said almost. On certain foggy nights, occasionally with some kind of a crazy propagation, where the lower antenna got 1 or 2 dB stronger signal than the upper antenna. It was a rare event, but it did occur. But 90-some-odd percent of the time, the upper antenna had 10 dB more signal. From both Dave Olean's experiment and my experiment, which throw an awful lot of monkey wrench into Joe Reiser's opinion, I'm now reasonably sure that in almost every location that you and I are likely to have, if you have the resources to raise your antenna higher, if you have the resources to put up more antenna, you're always going to get more signal in both transmit and receive. People are going to hear you better. People are going to compliment you more. You're going to talk a longer distance. You're going to have more fun. When I was using that array of 16 Yagis and talking 480 miles, lots of people in the New England area and in the New York metropolitan area and New Jersey were occasionally accusing me of creating a hoax. And the same thing was happening down in Greensboro, North Carolina. His local guys were saying, hey, Al, are you really doing this? I'm not hearing a thing. Well, they weren't using his kind of equipment. And the same thing with the people up here. They weren't using my kind of equipment. So they thought that we're running a hoax, transmitting signals back and forth, but we're really on the telephone. I had a number of people accuse us of that. Pretty soon there were some pretty well-equipped guys at 432 in the Washington, D.C. area, midway between the two of us, and they're flipping the antennas back and forth, and they're saying, holy mackerel, these guys are really doing it. This is not a hoax. On top of that, every Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock for a half hour, we did this for 4.5 solid years, every single week. That would be one hell of a phone bill if we were doing that as a hoax. So there was another piece of proof that it wasn't a hoax. I wonder if you heard any of those comments around those days of Christian Glenn, W2TTT, if you're still there, K2RIW.
All right. 7-3. That was fun. Yeah, that's really fun. I concur with Dave's experiment wholeheartedly.